San Diego's talk radio leader, 760 KFMB presents It's Your Money and Your Life. For the next hour, Richard Muzio and Joe Vecchio will educate and inform you on matters related to your financial future, your life, and your leisure. Now, with It's Your Money and Your Life, here are Richard and Joe.
All right, hello everybody. My name is Joe Vecchio, your co-host, announcer, and producer, coming to you from KFMB Studios with 50,000 watts of power. We're heard not just in San Diego County, but Orange County, LA County, up the coast of Seattle on a good night, out to the desert. And now time to introduce the main man of the hour. He is a CPA extraordinaire. He's a long-distance runner and marathoner. He is a family office advisor to several high-net-worth families, and he is a core member of Strategic Trusted Advisors Roundtable of San Diego. His name is Richard Muzio. Richard, good evening. How are you tonight?
I am marvelous. Happy holiday weekend to everybody.
Yes, sir. So how you doing? Any runs that you and Mary been doing?
I've got a half marathon coming up on June 2 to celebrate my 55th birthday. I'm running the Rock and Roll Half here in San Diego.
Wow. And just coming off of that, your tennis on court one of the famous Mother's Day massacre back on Mother's Day.
My magazine article got an amazing response. I am amazed at how many people had forgotten about that.
Just to reiterate.
Almost nobody remembered it.
Yeah, well, we did a whole show with Lauren Ecuil, who was Bobby Riggs' manager, but as most people know, and for the benefit of our guests in studio tonight, you were Bobby Riggs' 14-year-old scrapbook keeper and press clippings keeper.
Yep, my job in high school was making scrapbooks for legendary Bobby Riggs.
And how many volumes? Those are huge volumes. How many are those?
Yeah, I made 11 scrapbooks.
And how many pages total?
About 2,500 pages. With over 250 pages of hand-typed indices. And it's not 8.5 by 11. Those books are 11 by 17.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's 11 by 17 paper.
Well, I saw one of them, and if you hurl it at somebody, you could really do some damage.
You could do some damage. They are humongous.
And they're all up at the Bobby Riggs Museum. Well, at least one of them. He's starting to digitize them, Lorne.
Yeah, I got to pick another one up from Lorne to digitize another one. But they're all up at the tennis museum up in Encinitas.
But folks, I mean, that monumental match.
It was a media frenzy.
Yeah. The monumental match in Houston in the Astrodome with Bobby Riggs, Billie Jean King, actually did not. It proceeded from the Mother's Day Massacre, which happened here in Ramona, which gives San Diego a piece of that historic part of our background, you know.
And again, if Margaret Court had won that match, it never would have been the Battle of the Sexes against Billie Jean King. There wouldn't have been any reason to play that match. And a lot of people just don't remember the first one and how important it was to the whole sequence of events.
Which was the point of your article in East County Magazine. And if folks just go online and Google it, all the interesting factoids are
You can Google East County Magazine, or you can just, we put it up on our website too. So the article's up on our website, iymoney.com.
Yeah, we never plug our site enough. iymoney.com. Go there.
It's a cool website.
It is. There's a lot of good stuff there. Anyway, on with the show, or do you have anything else to discuss?
No, that's it. We've got a special guest tonight, but he's going to give us a 6-month update though on Hurricane Sandy first. But I'll mention his name and what he does. But the interesting thing is, this gentleman called in from a remote location because he had been severely affected in terms of being able to reach out by telephone in early November because of Hurricane Sandy. And that's Tom McLaughlin, who is, of course, a vice president with UBS and head of their municipal research. But we aired his show. Tom was on, I guess, calling from not your normal office back east when this hurricane was going on, because you guys were out of power. I think you had to move up to Connecticut, right, if memory serves?
Yeah, I was actually out of power at the house.
That's right.
For 9 days.
Nine days.
That was actually not that unusual back in the tri-state area. There were a lot of people out for about that long. So it was really something. We're kind of, we're getting back to it. There's still a few neighborhoods that were so damaged that it's going to be a couple of years before they come back. Breezy Point, in Brooklyn, being one example. Parts of Queens, parts of Brooklyn, the Jersey Shore, of course, which you hear a lot about. Mm-hmm. It'll be quite a while before some of those communities come back. However, at the same time, by and large, we actually came through it in terms of the rest of the metropolitan area reasonably well. Everybody got to the polls, because remember, that was just before the election.
Right.
And what we're trying to do now is clean up isolated communities right on the shore.
And you had mentioned that your brother lived literally on the beach and lost his whole beach,
The beach out in front of Allenhurst, New Jersey, was pretty much wiped out. They're actually hoping over the course of the summer that the sand replenishes naturally.
Mm-hmm.
And they're keeping their fingers crossed.
Tom, have there been any areas that have been just so devastated that they're not even bothering to rebuild because they're so flattened, or are they really making a concerted effort to restore?
No, they're all making a concerted effort to rebuild. You know, in terms of the Jersey Shore, of course, the economy of New Jersey is dependent to at least some degree on the tourism that comes mm-hmm. in to the shore. So a lot of the boardwalks on the Jersey Shore are actually being rebuilt as quickly as possible.
Hmm.
Again, there's just a few communities like Breezy Point, which I think I said was Brooklyn. I think it actually may be in Queens, but it's right down on the shore, and they just lost entire houses. I'm not sure I mentioned it when I was last on the program, but we actually had a colleague who lost her home. But when I say lost her home, it's gone.
Really?
It was basically scraped, wiped by the storm surge, and they never found it.
God, it's
wow.
Like a,
the entire house.
It's like a Rod Serling movie. You show up in your lot and your home is gone. Yeah. But you maybe like the Chicago fire in the late 1800s, you know, that wiped out a large parts of the city. But you know what? It stimulated a lot of construction and new. It really attracted a lot of world-class architects to Chicago and made it quite a city.
Well, so. you actually find that also here in California. You know, after the Loma Prieta quake in 89, the Northridge quake mm-hmm. in 94, there was a lot of damage, there was loss of life, and the tragedies that followed. But from an economic standpoint, in the year or two that followed those events, you actually had what we call the Home Depot effect, and people actually went back and rebuilt. I mean, we're a very resilient society, and, mm-hmm. and people will rebuild when there's mm-hmm. damage like that.
Yeah. Actually, Home Depot's doing pretty well, but we can't talk about individual things, right, Richard?
No, we can't, but I'm glad to hear things are getting back to normal.
Yeah. No,
I had a couple of friends who had signed up to run the New York Marathon, which, of course, it was a good decision, in my opinion, not to run it. I thought the mayor sort of pulled the trigger on that decision a little bit later than he should have, because some people had already, you know, made travel arrangements and the like. But
a lot of people who actually had who weren't going to make it in for the race that actually donated their hotel rooms to people
right.
who were basically left without their homes. That was a positive.
And how long were you without power, Tom?
Oh, it was about 9 days for myself.
Days.
Yeah, it's not that uncommon. This was not unique.
So what were you doing for food? I mean, obviously you couldn't open the fridge too many times. You had a lot of
everything in the fridge was gone. I mean, you basically
canned goods and cereal boxes.
You know, it's interesting. You know, people, the way people react, and I'm sure people who have been through earthquakes here, tornadoes elsewhere. You know, the first day or two, you're fighting it. You're coming together. By day four or five, it becomes a bit more tedious. By day eight. You really just want the electricity back on.
So. Well, it's a real exercise in survivorship, I'll tell you that. So,
anyway, glad to hear progress being made. So let's. You want to talk about bonds? Let's talk about bonds. Who wants to talk about bonds? So,
what do you want to talk about?
Well, let me ask this question. So, I was speaking to the Oregon Society of CPAs, and the AICPA put out their survey that this was the worst tax season in the history of the CPA business, which has nothing to do with bonds, except for the fact that my point is that we've now passed this April 15th deadline, which I guess represented the worst tax season in history, and the government's revenue is actually up sort of slightly. So the fact that we're past April 15th, does that make bonds look a little bit more optimistic than maybe people were thinking about earlier in the year?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We usually see a reasonably strong May for the municipal bond market, for example. After April 15th, right through about the middle of May, historically, over the course of the last decade, we've actually seen a pretty strong performance in the municipal bond market. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that people are obviously taking money out of municipal bond funds in order to basically meet their tax liabilities. And so there's more of an interest in repurchasing bonds. June tends to, and we actually said this in one of our recent reports. June tends to underperform May, and it's very interesting. You can actually go back a decade, and so you get the surge of buying that goes into May. The municipal bond market actually more or less performs better, and then in June it kind of slacks off a bit. So we're likely to see that again, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense, but I know tax revenues were actually up, which made the government happy.
Yeah, we got to pause right there, though, gentlemen. Stay tuned, everybody. We'll be right back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life right after these announcements. All right, back with more of It's Your Money and Your Life with our special guest, Tom McLaughlin from UBS, a municipal expert, and Richard Musio, the main man of the hour. Welcome back, gents.
Thanks.
Thanks, Joe. Yeah, so before we hit the break, we're talking about April 15th being the worst tax season in history, but the government also announced that income tax revenues were up. So, Tom, I wanted to ask you a question, that being the fact you know, the sequestration on the heels of the fiscal cliff and now the debt ceiling. Is this going to make the opposing parties less inclined or more inclined to come up with some solution on the debt ceiling now that tax revenues appear to be higher than maybe were originally projected?
Well, what it's going to do is it's actually going to basically postpone the next crisis or the next fiscal cliff until September, because the combination of sequestration, which is slowing down federal expenditures, combined with the fact that we've got the higher payroll tax and the higher marginal income tax rate, at least the higher maximum marginal income tax rate, has driven more revenues in. So as a consequence, we're at a point right now where, starting in September, we're all going to get a feeling of deja vu. You remember the whole media coverage of fiscal cliff?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's coming back, and it's going to come back right after Labor Day. And that's at that point, you're going to have a confluence of events, and you're going to have the continuing resolution by which the federal government actually runs the government. It's the budget, effectively, is going to expire, and they have to basically come to agreement on a new one because the federal fiscal year expires on September 30th. You've got the debt ceiling, which formally expires at the end of this week, but because revenues are higher and expenditures are lower, it's actually going to allow the Treasury to avoid busting through the debt ceiling up until middle of September. So you're going to basically have all these circumstances coming together at the very same time that Congress is coming back after their August break, mm-hmm. and there's going to be everybody, you know, ignoring the issue right up until September, and then everybody's going to start worrying about it, and media coverage is going to be pretty high.
Great. Now I know what I can watch on TV in September.
Well, you can turn off the TV.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. So is this going to be good or bad for the bond market in general?
Well, you know, it's going to create a lot of uncertainty, and that's never really good.
Yeah, it's never really good.
One of the things that conceivably could happen, you know, right now what's going on is Chairman Baucus in the Senate Finance Committee and Chairman Camp in the House Ways and Means Committee. Baucus is a Democrat, Camp is a Republican. They actually personally get along pretty well, and they are both eager to enact some sort of tax reform. And this has been out there for quite a while. It's been talked about on and off the last 2 years. We don't have a high degree of confidence that it's actually going to happen, but those two gentlemen are trying to leave behind a legacy. Baucus is retiring in the next cycle, and Chairman Camp is under Republican conference rules, has to step down as chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. So they are both looking at a limited amount of time in order to basically drive a consensus among their colleagues to basically pursue a tax reform agenda. And it conceivably that this whole talk about tax reform actually will probably occur at around the same time as the debt ceiling debate has to start and the continuing resolution expires and we have to basically think about the budget again, the federal budget. So that's why everything's going to be kind of quiet through the summer, I think, and then right after Labor Day, it's you know, all heck's going to break loose again.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, mate, because I was speaking with one of the guests at the UBS Family Office Conference. It was in Beverly Hills really early in May, and I was making the point that if there was ever going to be a time for tax reform in this country, that time is now.
Well, it is. You know, there's a real feeling among, I think, citizens in the United States that the federal deficit is too large, it's growing too quickly, we have to do something about it. But when you think about it, you take a look at the dynamics in Washington, and the Democratic Party in Washington is not keen on fundamental entitlement reform. The Republican Party is not keen on overt increases in tax rates either. So if you've got widespread popular concern about the size of the federal deficit, but you are not likely to get overtly higher tax rates, and you're not likely to get comprehensive reform of entitlement programs, which are one of the things that's driving the federal deficit in the first place. How do you go ahead and respond? How do you go ahead and fix the problem? And that's where tax reform comes in, and that's why the debate will occur. Whether it actually passes is a separate question, but the debate occurs because what happens is whenever you see a person running for office saying, I want to broaden the base, what they're really suggesting is they want to go ahead, reduce the actual marginal tax rate, but also limit your ability to take deductions and limit the number of tax shelters, or as they call it inside the Beltway, tax expenditures. So the mortgage interest deduction, municipal tax exemptions, state and local taxes, the value of the insurance you receive from your employer, all these things constitute lost federal revenue. And if you lower the income tax rate through a tax reform program, you also have to limit the ability to take those kind of tax deductions.
Yeah, and I think there might be a good chance of actually reducing the corporate tax rate, but also limiting certain corporate deduction as well.
Indeed. And the corporate tax rate in the United States is among the highest, of course, in the developed economies. Mm-hmm. So it's certainly on the agenda as well, as is the AMT. You know, the AMT is highly unpopular among taxpayers. It's highly unpopular in Congress. The problem is that it's generating enough revenue at this point that you just simply can't eliminate it unless you basically, you know, take a more comprehensive approach to the whole tax code.
Yeah, AMT means alternative minimum tax. We actually have a joke around the office. Well, there's two jokes around the office. When we have a client who has a tax return who's not in alternative minimum tax, we run around the office and show it to everybody else because we hardly ever see somebody who's not in alternative minimum tax.
Every year it captures more and more taxpayers. Yeah.
And then the other joke is we already have a flat tax system in this country because if you happen to live in California that has ridiculously high state income taxes and ridiculously high real estate taxes, and you're at all successful, you're going to be an alternative minimum tax because you usually have these two humongous deductions that are deductible for regular tax but not for alternative minimum tax, and therefore you wind up in alternative minimum tax. It really affects states that have high real estate taxes as well as high income taxes, which California qualifies on both counts.
It does, and that's driving some of the enthusiasm, at least among, I think, Chairman Kemp and Chairman Box, to actually address this. The problem is that we're at a point right now where already both parties are looking towards the next midterm election, and that's a bit disheartening, but it's true. And a lot of the decisions that get made for the remainder of this calendar year into next year are going to be within the context of what happens in November of 2014.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of California and California bonds, I know a phenomenon that happened here with regard to tax revenues in California because of the increase in the federal capital gains rate from 15% to 20%. This year, a lot of people took capital gains at the end of 2012, thus accelerating maybe some income tax revenue would be the best way to describe it into the state of California's budget that otherwise might not have come in ever or until 2013, 2014, and so on. What do you see going on here in California?
Well, you know, the California budget is in better shape. You know, I've been asked this question a lot. High earners obviously saw the passage of Prop 30, and their tax liabilities increased. They did so retroactively, of course,
right,
at the beginning of the
year. Right, to 1/1/12, right?
Right, exactly. And that was never, you know, people are not going to look forward to that situation. But interestingly enough, from an investment standpoint, the California General Obligation Bond and the credit of the state of California improved with Prop 30. So it's kind of a bifurcated situation. Taxpayers, high-earning taxpayers are looking at this and saying, now I'm paying more taxes, and that's a burden indeed. For those investing in California GO bonds, it actually improved the credit outlook just because there are more revenues coming in. And we're in the process in California of beginning to work off the accumulated deficit we had because of the higher revenues coming into Sacramento.
But will there be a compounding effect if people took gains in 12? Does California expect revenue to decrease because a lot of people simply won't be taking capital gains then in 13 and 14 and
well,
so on?
Well, it's tough to predict. I mean, because you've got a strong equity market right now. And when you have a strong equity market, there's a loose correlation back with state income tax receipts just because the state of California, like about 35, 36 other states, actually assess the same tax rate on capital gains as they do on ordinary income. So as a consequence, when you're in a position where you've got very strong equity gains, that's usually good for the state budget. But, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that makes the state budget in California so volatile is that income tax. It's a dominant source, personal income tax. It is a dominant source of revenue for the state operations, the state government. And since it is so tied to capital gains taxes, you're really tied into the natural economic cycle. When the equity market does well, you get these big surges in revenue. And the key is how much discipline the state legislature is going to exert in terms of holding back expenditures so you don't overexpend when you got a good year, because you know that in the future years you're not going to get the big income tax receipts because you're not going to get those big capital gains.
So did most states show increase in tax revenue? I maybe don't know the answer to that question. I'm just curious if California was an anomaly.
No, it's not an anomaly, but the different states showed it for different reasons. You know, some states showed it, like, for example, in California, you showed it for among the reasons you had a higher tax rate. It was retroactive, so a lot of that increase was due to the fact that the rate went up. In other cases, you actually saw income tax receipts and state sales tax receipts increasing just because of natural improvement in the local economy.
Wow, we've got it. They flew through there. We got to come back with more of It's Your Money in Your Life after news, sports, weather, and other announcements. Hang on. All right, we are back with It's Your Money and Your Life, and over to Richard to thank all of our terrific sponsors.
We want to thank all of our sponsors, and they're all terrific. UBS, our major sponsor. Of course, they're here in studio with us this evening. Mr. Michael Carantra and Drew Freitas, our special guest, Tom McLaughlin with UBS, very much appreciated. Rich Gaines with Family Legacy Legal, the best estate planning attorney here in San Diego. My good friend Joel Grushkin with Cost Segregation Initiatives, helping real estate owners improve their cash flow. Jason Kruger, who's going to be a guest here coming up in June, with Signature Analytics, the best CFO company in San Diego. Carl Sheeler in Business Valuations, helping business owners improve the values of their businesses. our favorite CPAs who did indeed survive the worst tax season in history with great aplomb. That would be Polito Epic CPAs, Don Epic and Paul Polito up in Vista. And last but certainly not least, let me try that again. Last but certainly not least, are the best business bank that we know of, Regents Bank here in San Diego with Mr. Sean Puckett and Mr. Steve Sefton. So thank you to all of our sponsors. And Joe, how can our listeners learn more about our great sponsors?
Well, if you just fire up your computer or your smartphone or whatever device you're using, get on iymoney.com, click on sponsors. All of their contact information and biographical information and professional information is there. So check them out. They're all great and high-quality sponsors, Richard, aren't they? I mean, you've worked with these
people. Oh, they're all incredible. They're the best west of the Mississippi, I tell everybody.
I mean, these people didn't just call you up yesterday and say, hey, we want to sponsor your show. I mean, you've known
They were handpicked.
Right.
They were handpicked. This is the cream of the crop. This is the starting lineup, if you know what I mean, in the major leagues.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. And also my article again on the Margaret Court Bobby Riggs Mother's Day Massacre recently went up on the website. So if you want a really good and interesting read, check that out, because you're going to learn a lot of things you didn't know about the women's liberation movement.
Well, not only
it's
that,
not just about tennis.
You know what we forgot to mention, Richard? The documentary, which you and I stimulated, will be the public will be seeing it sometime within the next this year, within the next few months. It is going to be released.
Well, are we going to see the version before? I just want to make sure incorrect.
I think we'll get a preliminary copy of that. But the company that made Man on Wire, which won the Oscar, made this film.
New Black Films. So, and by the way, my book on the same matter is coming out, in about 2 months.
Yeah, so.
So you gotta go to Costco and buy that, because I'm going to be in Costco.
All right.
All right, hey, so getting back to financial matters, a gentleman named Paul Donovan with UBS wrote a really interesting article that deals with countries like Japan and the United States and Europe in a general sense. But the heading was, global liquidity does not exist. It is often cited, of course, but global liquidity is entirely a product of the heated imaginations of overexcited politicians who wish to blame foreigners, whether that be the Fed, the Bank of Japan, or anyone but themselves, for domestic economic problems. Tom, you didn't write this, but one of your great analysts did. What do you think about this comment?
Paul does have a way with words, doesn't he?
He did. Well, he's from the UK. He's one of those Oxford guys.
I was going to say, that must be it, right? It's not the New York City that I grew up in. Okay.
And as a footnote, might I just add, Japan's national debt is 230% of its gross domestic product. Ours is like 100%. I mean, doesn't that boggle your mind?
But here's the thing. A lot of people, when I say global liquidity does not exist, they go, what? That can't be true.
Well, you know what's interesting about this is that the Federal Reserve has pursued a policy which a lot of people have come to call financial repression, right? Mm-hmm. This is the notion of stimulating the economy with a very aggressive monetary policy for the better part of 5 years. And they did that for a variety of reasons, but one of which is that they were very, very concerned about deflation.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you had the Federal Reserve stimulating the economy through a whole variety of means, most recently of which has been these asset purchases of treasury bonds, agency bonds, and mortgage bonds. And what's interesting is that the actual supply of those bonds are beginning to diminish in terms of the fact that they're sitting on the balance sheet for the Fed. And the key to remember why this is going on is that Chairman Bernanke is very concerned about the Federal Reserve repeating the mistake of 1936-37, mm-hmm. where money was pulled out of the system too quickly, and we actually went into recession again, which people sometimes forget, mm-hmm. in the late 30s and didn't come out of it again until the Second World War. He is not about to make that same mistake twice, and therefore he's going to go ahead and keep his foot on the accelerator until we have two pieces of data. And I'm sure you guys have talked about this before, but the unemployment rate at 6.5%, mm-hmm. the inflation rate at 2.5% going out and looking out on a persistent basis for a year. Those are the two things that he's going to concentrate on. The one thing that's really interesting about this is that there's a great book out there. I don't know if you've heard about it. It's called Signal in the Noise.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's a really good book. But what's interesting is we're deluged with data, and you got to figure out which one's important. And for the Fed, the ones that are important are the unemployment rate and the inflation rate. And if we get to the point where we have sustainable inflation, sustainable reduction in unemployment, you'll actually get a reversal of policy. Until that time, going back to Donovan's piece, from a liquidity perspective, we're still going to have the Federal Reserve dominating this monetary policy.
Is there some concern or debate over what is the real unemployment number, though? Because
there's a lot of debate about that. Mm-hmm. It's the labor force participation rate, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, when you don't consider yourself to be part of the labor force and you take yourself out of it, you're not counted. So a lot of people have said, well, the unemployment rate is actually...
But when your benefits run out, also you're not counted, right?
Right, yeah. As long as you've basically withdrawn from the labor force. Right. If you're saying you're not looking anymore, you're not counted.
Okay.
So what happens is, as the question that a lot of people are debating right now is, as the economy improves and people come back into the labor force, is that actually going to delay the reduction in unemployment rate, because you have more people being counted as unemployed because now they're looking again because the economic prospects are improving?
Mm-hmm.
About half of this reduction, we think, is attributable to that kind of a scenario. Some of it's just attributable to the baby boomers retiring. Mm-hmm. They actually are coming out of labor force, but they would do so naturally.
Yeah.
So it's not all people just simply not looking, but some of it is, yeah.
10,000 people a day turn 65.
But we also have a large number of college graduates and high school graduates coming up here in about 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month, depending on, to me, I don't know about back east, but in San Diego, college graduates are having a really difficult time finding employment.
No, absolutely. I mean, unless they're coming out with a mathematics
or
engineering or technology degree.
STEM.
Yeah, STEM. I mean, it's almost two different paths. If you come out with a chemical engineering degree or an electrical engineering, computer engineering, that's not going to be a problem. But if you're coming out, you know, with an English degree, mm-hmm. you know, it becomes more challenging. Mm-hmm. It definitely does.
No question. So how about real estate? Joe, you had a question on real estate. You want to ask it?
Well, how the real estate market, and actually it seems to be improving in part right now, although some people say it might be a bubble. But, you know, obviously the loss of tax revenue for governments when we had the big real estate problem, how does that factor into the bond market, and how is it looking now and into the future?
Well, we actually think the U.S. housing industry is leading the recovery process. It's an incremental improvement. Mm-hmm. This is not an improvement that's going to basically take off dramatically. But the statistics that we've seen over the course of the last 6 months does show that the U.S. housing market is on the mend. If you take the Case-Shiller 20-City Home Price Index, year over year, we're showing good improvement. The 90-day mortgage delinquency rate is falling, which is good news. The foreclosure filings by banks are declining as well. And we've got the number of homes with negative equity is also going down. It's still elevated. It's still too high.
Yeah.
But the number of mortgages with negative equity is declining. And this is a positive. The housing is obviously an important part of the economy. What's really interesting about this is that it's not the sheer number, I should say, of individuals employed in housing construction. It's the multiplier effect. It goes back to the Home Depot. We talked about that earlier at the top of the program. It's this notion that there's a lot of multipliers that are associated with home construction and new home purchases, and even second home purchases.
The title industry. I mean, all these things are factoring.
But here in Southern California, we're seeing an interesting phenomenon. That is that a lot of the purchases of real estate are coming from foreign sources, be that south of the border in Mexico or from China.
Yeah, and
we're seeing this fleeing of capital from other jurisdictions or locations.
Yeah, we see it in Southern California. We see it also in South Florida, and the question then is how sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Right, that was going to be my next question. How sustainable?
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting because on the one hand, you don't necessarily want to turn these investors away because they actually are picking up supply that needed to basically be picked up. At a certain point in time, the economy is going to be more reliant on domestic demand. And by the way, this again is a function of the economy here in California. It's a function of the Florida economy. This is not a dynamic that you're going to find in the Midwest.
Mm. Right? No, understood. Right. Understood.
But Americans have bought property overseas too. So anyway, we'll be back with the last segment of It's Your Money in Your Life right after this. Hang on. All right, we're back with the last segment of It's Your Money Life with UBS municipal expert Tom McLaughlin and Richard Musio, CPA. And welcome back, gents, for the last segment.
Joe, thanks. Hey, if anybody wants access to the great research material that we're quoting on the show, Tom has a great article about the municipal bond market. Again, we reference Paul Donovan's article on global liquidity. You can call Michael Quaranta at UBS at 858-551-9422, and he can email you some just fascinating reading material. Again, a lot of which we are alluding to or referencing here on the show. Again, Michael Quaranta at UBS, 858-551-9422. So we only have a quarter of the show left. I wanted to cover a couple of other topics. Tom, I've been hearing about this thing called the American Renaissance in manufacturing. Is this real, or is this somebody's dream?
No, it's not a dream. I think we're on the cusp of seeing that kind of a renaissance in manufacturing.
And why is that?
Because of the cost of natural gas in the United States, if it compares so favorably to the rest of the world. We're pulling more natural gas and oil as a byproduct of some of this shale manufacturing or shale exploitation. But the cost of gas here is probably $4 per per metric unit. It's five times that, or four times that amount in Japan. It's three times that in Europe.
Wow.
So to some degree, we're in a position here where we believe that the North American continent, Canada, United States, and Mexico, taken together, will be energy independent by 2020. And so that's going to change geopolitics in a huge way. Also, from a manufacturing perspective, you have manufacturers who are looking at this source of cheap energy, natural gas, as a way to go ahead and bring more manufacturing onshore, or at least back to Mexico, and from Asia back to Mexico, back to the United States. And I think it has a transformative quality to it.
Where are the major hubs of production? I think it's the Dakotas or up in that region of the country.
One of the interesting, it is the Dakotas, it's Montana, it's Texas, it's Pennsylvania. But one of the largest natural gas reserves in the country is called the Monterey Formation here in California. And the question really becomes, at what point will the state legislature pursue a policy to allow some of that natural gas to be exploited? It may take a while here in California, but it has been identified. USC came out with an excellent study that actually made projections as to how much gas was under the Monterey Formation. It's primarily in the Central Valley. The formation actually does extend to the Pacific at certain points, but it's primarily a Central Valley play.
Well, we certainly know there's a lot of gas coming out of Sacramento, so anyway.
Thanks, Joe. Hey, Tom, you wrote a really interesting research piece. Well, I guess it's the first of a two-part series. It's called Spotlight on America's Airports. And I know what the country is going to do about America's infrastructure is obviously a hotly debated political issue. But I found the reading on the airports really, really, really fascinating because I think there's been some misdirection with regard to the federal's involvement in the airport.
Well, there has been, and it also is a little bit disheartening. We looked at a recent study that the Brookings Institution had done in terms of where all the origin and destination of passengers occurs versus where the federal government spends money. And what was interesting is you can take the 26 largest metropolitan areas. They capture 3/4 of all domestic travelers. Okay, so you get 26 metro area airports, and there's more than one in some places, capturing 3/4 of the travelers. The problem is rather than directing the federal assistance to the busiest airports, just 21.8% of the airline improvement grants were directed to these gateways. So what you've got is a situation where the federal government is trying, probably based on political negotiations in Washington, they're directing federal investment, federal grant money widely across the country rather than directing it into the most busiest airports.
And then for investors well, let me ask the question differently. Isn't there also on the horizon maybe some airline consolidation that might affect bondholders of
Well, it depends on what kind of a bond. And this is really important because there are three or four different types of airport bonds or bonds that are related to airport. The General Airport Revenue Bond, we call them the GARB. Right?
That's the GARB.
The General Airport Revenue Bond is the most common type of airport bond that's issued. And there's not a lot of correlation, interestingly enough, between the health of those bonds, the health of the cities in which the airports are located, and the health of the airlines. And you might ask why. And it really has to do with the fact that airports are types of infrastructure that are very, very difficult to replicate. Right? The last major airport that was built is now 20 years old in Denver, right? Denver International Airport. That was underway for 10 years. It's not something you can simply replicate. And when you think about the number of airports up and down the West Coast, there are three major international gateways at LAX, SFO, and SeaTac up in Washington. And you have other airports such as San Diego Airport, which is functioning. It's exceptionally important to the local economy, of course. And you simply just can't pick it up and drop it somewhere else very easily.
Boy, they've been studying the issue here
have.
For years.
Yeah, right? They have, right? But but they keep coming back to the notion where this is not something you just do overnight, right?
Yeah.
And so and interestingly enough, more than 90%, which is not surprising, perhaps more than 90% of the travelers coming through San Diego Airport are either originating here or destined to be here. In other words, they're not hubbing through San Diego. And as a consequence, when you look at the General Airport Revenue Bond for San Diego, it actually offers interesting opportunity in terms from an investment standpoint because regardless of whether or not it's American and U.S. Air having merged or Delta and Northwest having merged or United, Southwest, JetBlue, whoever you want to choose, if one of them has a problem, there is a competitor that will serve the local population who needs to either, you know, to use the airport itself. So that's how you distinguish between the airlines. Now, the two other types that I'll mention very quickly are passenger facility bonds. Those are secured by the taxes or the charges that you'll see at the bottom of your airline ticket, for those of us who still carry paper tickets. And that's basically on a per diem or a per head, per capita basis, I should say. The third type is not an airport revenue bond per se, and this is exceptionally important. These are special facility bonds, and people sometimes misinterpret those as airport bonds. These are bonds that are secured solely by the lease of an airline for a specific piece of property or a specific terminal, a specific hangar. And as a consequence, those bonds are tied directly to the health of the airlines. So it, you have to be a little careful as to what kind of bonds you're looking at when it comes to this. But the GARBs are actually pretty good shape.
Interesting.
By and large.
But given the capital needs required, I mean, wouldn't it project to be the case that there's going to be more borrowing needed over the next 5, 6, 8, 10, whatever years?
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, although the airline improvement program that I mentioned before is not subject to sequestration, you would reasonably expect that going forward over the next 10 years, given what we're facing with the federal budget, there's not going to be a ton of money that are being circulated. So those large airports, the two dozen, let's call them, largest airports in the country, are going to be reliant on their own resources. And those resources basically are the borrowing that, mm-hmm. that these airports do in the municipal bond market, because they don't get enough money from the federal government because that money is largely misdirected.
Interesting. Well, interesting. Yeah, I had dinner two nights ago with the gentleman who said, I didn't realize San Diego was an international airport. That was his comment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, if you got one flight across the border, you constitute as an international airport.
I know,
airport.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I think because if it's such, you know, it's such a small size, he's like, wait a minute. I've been to L.A. I've been to New York. This is not an international airport. I don't care what they call it.
Well, our new mayor has explored the thought of bringing the Olympic Games to the San Diego Tijuana region. Oh, that would
across the border, right? I recently read that when I came into town.
That's a pretty grandiose thought, right, Richard?
Well, it's grandiose, yes and no. I certainly think we have the facilities. I mean, we have the Olympic Training Center down in the South Bay. I certainly think we have the facilities.
Gosh, we are out of time.
Tom, thank you for flying 3,000 miles just to spend an hour with us.
Yeah, thank
My
you.
My pleasure, guys.
Thank
Good
you,
seeing
thank
you.
Thank you, Michael, for being in studio with us. Tom, thanks for the kind words you always say about this show, and we really appreciate it. So, hey, Justin Hart on the board, thank you very much. And Dan Noon, his assistant, was in there as well. Thanks to Craig Blank, our con executive, and our programming genius, Dave Sniff. You have a great week, everyone.